people just take for granted everything we have, and that they use it and don't think about what it's doing to our climate, and don't think about the fact that everything could change when they're older. They just kind of live for what they've got at the moment and don't care about the future.
Canada's Clean Air Act will allow us to move industry from voluntary compliance to strict regulation.
Harper says he's proposing a serious made-in-Canada solution to combat smog and global warming. That means Alberta's oil industry, the principal cause of greenhouse gas emissions in Canada, will face tougher restrictions.
You know what one of the big fears? A lot of critics suggest that this government is pro-West and it's pro-oil industry, it's pro-Alberta, and that's why they want to go after smog and leave climate change alone. Do you buy into that?
Prime Minister, we're looking at this as your green plan, but you don't seem to have any timelines attached to it, so how can that be a plan? And just to follow up, I understand from estimates you're spending about 10 times more money to fight smog instead of going after the greenhouse gases that produce, many say, global warming.
We will be consulting extensively with industry. In the weeks and months that lie ahead, our government will consult extensively with industry. We will be consulting extensively with industry.
He says he's going to consult for another year. So we'll have another year of dirty air without action.
I mean, it was Mr. Mulroney who told Mr. Harper that climate change was the single biggest threat facing humanity, except for perhaps global nuclear war. Stephen Harper is a carbon copy of George Bush, and not just on this file, but in this one, the pun is intentional. We are following George Bush's approach on intensity targets. Bush invented that. And we're calling something a Clean Air Act. Reminds me very much of George Bush's Clear Skies program that resulted in more air pollution.
Good afternoon. This is Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You've just heard from Elizabeth May, the new leader of the Green Party of Canada, and she's our special guest speaker later on in the program as she talks about Canada's largest single source of new greenhouse gases, and that's the Alberta oil sands. We have a lot to learn about that as Canadians, about how we're contributing to the climate change that is ruining our forests, drying out our rivers, drying out the rainforests indeed themselves. This is also one of our special member drive programs. We're going to be asking you during the show to give us a call at Co-op Radio and renew your membership if it's expiring, or to become a new member. And this is so important. This station is not funded by great big corporations. We need your support absolutely to keep on the air. And this is why you can hear some of the real truth about what's happening with your climate and with your planet generally, as well as a lot of other great alternative voices that corporate media simply won't fund. So get behind it. Get behind CFRO and send in your donations. We'll tell you how in just a minute.
Come and get it.
Great radio this October during the 2006 Fall Member Drive.
Former Senate investigator Harold Weissman. The Harvey office was killed by an actor.
Archives to new artists. Tough investigative reporting. Pink Floyd meets Noam Chomsky on your radio station, CFRO 102.7. Keep it on the air. Sign up starting October 12th. Co-op Radio 102.7 FM Vancouver. Join us. So here's the deal. We haven't spent a lot of money printing up big t-shirts or getting posters out, or we're not going to send you a $100 special video package, because we need the money to pay the rent, to pay our skeleton staff, perhaps to upgrade a little bit of our ancient computer equipment and keep this radio station on the air. All you have to do for a whole year of good radio listening is contribute $50 for an annual membership. Or if you're on fixed income, we can even do it for $25 for a whole year. Or perhaps you can contribute $10 or $20 a month from your bank account, give up a few of the lattes, and keep us going here at Co-op Radio CFRO 102.7. So call up at 604-684-7561. 684-7561. Either myself or my control room operator, John Stanger, who's volunteered graciously to take your calls, will quickly fill out a membership form for you if you don't have one, or renew your membership if you do. And there you go, another year of great radio. Do your part and feel good about yourself. We'll certainly appreciate it. Give us a call now at 684-7561. And while you do that, we're going to move on to a feature about the Alberta tar sands that was done for Radio EcoShock. And believe me, we've got a lot to learn about how we're the major drug pusher for energy for the United States. If climate change is going to rearrange millions of people, perhaps kill millions of people, we may even see Americans moving up to Canada. We may see Canadians moving up to Dawson Creek because the climate is changing over the next 100 years. My kids care about this. My grandkids, when they come, I hope will care about this because they'll be living the reality. Let's do something about it. So give us a call, 684-7561, while we check out this documentary feature on the Alberta tar sands from Radio EcoShock. The Canadian Tar Baby. News from Radio EcoShock. As a self-styled progressive country, Canada just hosted the Kyoto and Climate Convention meetings in Montreal last December. Various government ministers, including Prime Minister Martin himself, made speeches and twisted arms for international action on climate change. But under the hood, Canada remains the SUV gas guzzler. Under the Kyoto Protocol, Canada promised to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions to 6% below the 1990 levels by the year 2012. Instead, Canada has constantly added more and more greenhouse gases. In 2005, it was a whopping 24% above 1990 levels. Canadians drive incredible distances in gas-hungry vehicles, waste tons of carbon through leaky, inefficient homes and commercial buildings, and always leave the lights on everywhere. When it comes to belching greenhouse gases, Canadians are just Americans with a glossy green self-image. But here is the worst part. Who is the number one carbon pusher to the United States? Alrighty now, for all the life on Earth, here's your question. Who is the biggest energy supplier to the world's biggest climate polluter?
Saudi Arabia.
Venezuela.
Alex, I think it's Canada.
While spouting rhetoric about clean energy and global action, Canada is the number one carbon drug pusher to America. From Newfoundland offshore oil platforms in the Atlantic, from new fields in the western provinces, through new billion-dollar pipelines running like black rivers to American refineries, Canada feeds the needs of the world's largest carbon polluter. If Americans are addicts, Canada is certainly the drug pusher. Now Canada has found a seemingly inexhaustible source of oil, billions of barrels, enough to send the Earth's climate into a blazing hell full of storms, or perhaps to tip the planet into the new ice age. While Canadians cheer and U.S. Republicans cozy up to a war-free carbon fix, the entire biosphere is threatened by the Canadian tar sands. What are the tar sands? Can they really power the world for centuries? Is it worth scraping away vast areas to do it? If you like living in a world suitable for animals, you need to know about the Canadian tar baby. Let's go straight to oil industry sources. There is a fine three-part series on Alberta's tar sands in Greenwire, starting August 18, 2005. You can find Greenwire at www.eenews.net/greenwire.php. The series was republished in another good insider source called RigZone at www.rigzone.com. The facts. Alberta is a gigantic province on the western edge of the Canadian prairies. It is so rich in regular oil and gas fields that Albertans receive a check from their government. The province has no debt whatsoever and boasts a multi-billion-dollar rainy day fund. Alberta produces 70% of Canada's oil, 80% of its natural gas, and receives three-quarters of the billions of tax dollars given away to multinational oil companies every year to encourage them to mine more carbon. In the north, a frontier town called Fort McMurray is the center of one of the most staggering engineering and mining exploits ever seen on the planet Earth. Foreign-owned companies, mostly American, are engaged in strip mining and drilling 54,000 square miles, ripping away the surface of the earth in an area the size of Florida, just to keep those Hummers going for the commute. 120 million years ago, the detritus of plant life from another carbon-rich age became worked into sand to form a sticky black goo 50 to 100 feet below the current landscape of boreal forest, swamps, and lakes. These are the tar sands, also known as the oil sands. According to the Alberta government, there are 1.6 trillion, that's a trillion, barrels of oil locked up in this substance called bitumen. There are 175 billion barrels of oil of proven reserves ready for today's technology to grab, making the Alberta tar sands second only to Saudi Arabia. At present, 29 companies are pulling out 1 million barrels a day, almost all of it going to the United States. Corporations say that production will triple by 2015, making the Alberta tar sands the fifth largest oil producer in the world. As oil prices rise, the tar sands become more and more attractive. A whole string of U.S. congressmen and officials have already visited the Alberta operations. Even Dick Cheney was slated to tour the Black Bonanza. Major corporations like Shell have already pumped billions and billions of dollars into development of the tar sands. But getting the oil out of the sticky sand isn't cheap or good for the environment. The oil is locked in, requiring a complex system to crack it away. That process needs whole rivers of water and entire natural gas fields just to get the oil ready for refineries. Experts expect that by 2010, that's just 4 years away, oil sands production alone will take up 12% of the total energy allowed under the Kyoto Protocol for Canadian use. That is, the tar sands operations themselves produce massive amounts of carbon waste before a single gallon reaches consumers. The Black Gold Rush has pummeled local Aboriginal tribes and opened a flood of crummy fast food chains and strip malls to serve the oil workers. Houses in Fort McMurray, previously worth $60,000, now cost up to $500,000. Thousands of workers are sharing accommodations bunked up while working insane hours for a strip mining operation that runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All this is the model for U.S. politicians and oil lobbyists, like Senator Orrin Hatch, that want similar production from the oil-bearing shales in the American Rocky Mountains, including in parklands and public lands. The Energy Policy Act of 2005 was loaded with corporate goodies for anyone wanting to rip the shale out of the mountains and melt it down for oil. Back in the Badlands, the world's largest 400-ton trucks, more than two stories high, haul away the black goo from equally gigantic shovel machines. Sometimes they mine it, but most of the time they strip it away up to 100 feet of the land, which they haul away into gigantic slag heaps. The tar sands have to be crushed and then turned into a mobile slurry with amazing amounts of water. The slurry is passed through furnaces almost as hot as the sun and pressed with hydrogen, which unites with the carbon to form a hydrocarbon. But what is the source of all this hydrogen? It comes from natural gas from Canada's north. So this cleaner-burning fuel is wasted to create the dirtier oil. Canadians have heard about the proposed giant Mackenzie Valley pipeline to bring natural gas south from the Arctic. But gas-hungry Canadians and Americans will never see it for their heating. The entire production of the new pipeline would be sucked up by the Alberta tar sand companies. Incidentally, due to the tar sands, Canadian technicians are learning more about handling hydrogen. For one thing, there are hydrogen storage facilities close enough to homes and energy operations to create the equivalent of a hydrogen bomb if accidentally or purposefully touched off. Another big risk. Almost every multinational oil company is involved. One of the big producers, Syncrude, is owned by a consortium that includes Imperial Oil, Petro-Canada, ConocoPhillips, and Murphy Oil. Shell is also a major player, operating its own massive tar sands facilities. Where the land cannot be easily stripped away, due to overlying rock, the companies drill down and inject gigajoules of heat, again from the natural gas burners, to melt the tar below, enough to pump it up. The corporations spend a few $1 million explaining how green they are, while hauling away billions of dollars in profits and product. Stephen Hazel of the Sierra Club of Canada told Greenwire, "When they talk about how well they're doing, it's in the context of the filthiest industry one can imagine. I can't think of another industry that causes so much damage." So, the big machinery strips away entire forests and landscapes, leaving barren holes as lifeless as the moon. Then they truck in some of the slag and try to smooth it over and replant something. Nothing natural is left. Even the recovery efforts use up massive amounts of energy as diesel equipment moves mountains of materials. Syncrude says it reclaims about 740 acres a year. They have thousands of acres to go as they operate the largest crude oil production in Canada, amounting to 13% of all the energy used by Canadians, except the oil doesn't go to Canadians, but to their wealthier cousins to the south. Sulfur pours out of the processing plants, creating more acid rain. Just one company, Syncrude, pumps out 245 metric tons of sulfur dioxide every day. The Shell Tar Sands project adds millions of tons of sulfur to the atmosphere every year. Syncrude produced about 700 tons of sulfuric acid as well, the second largest source in Canada. The tailing ponds, really tailing lakes, are left while most of the noxious chemicals settle to the bottom. Toxic lakes loaded with chemicals like toluene and trimethylbenzene. Syncrude released 480 tons of toluene into the environment in a single year, the largest source of this deadly chemical in Canada. Just dumped into the environment, for free. The whole underground water system has been wiped out. Much of the Athabasca River is being rerouted to oil plants because it takes at least 2 barrels of water to produce a single barrel of oil. The Pembina Institute estimates the tar sands are currently using enough water to service the needs of a city of 2 million people. And it all comes out the other side dirty and polluted with persistent chemicals. You can get a full report on the oil sand fever from pembina.org. The ground-level insects, plants, and fungi have been destroyed. The plan is to replace it all with artificial rolling hills with grassland someday. Meanwhile, the former residents are unsettled. The caribou, moose, and deer flee the constant noise and the confusion of pipelines, pads, and pumps crisscrossing their former habitat. The wolves follow the pipeline cuts to find easy access to their prey, and megaflocks of migratory birds land in the toxic lakes. Like George Bush in America, Alberta's government has steadfastly opposed the Kyoto Protocol. They just want more and more oil production and more provincial revenues, no matter what happens to the Earth's delicate climate. Damn the hurricanes, the Arctic, and the species. Haul away the land and the animals. We need more oil! More oil! More oil! This report from Radio EcoShock, ECO, shocklikeanelectricshock.org. For some reason, we can't seem to get little documentaries like that on the air or opinions about the Alberta tar sands going in the major newspapers and television stations of Canada or the United States. That's why we need Co-op Radio, and we need your support. Members keep us on the air, and Radio EcoShock needs your support. This is a brand new program, you may have noticed. The former founder of Green Monkey has gone on to do other things and live other lives, leaving us a space to talk to you about the environment. Give us a call at 684-7561, and either myself or John Pranger will take your call. It's easy to sign up for membership. Give us a call. We'll tell you how. But now we need to know that there's some listeners out there who care about climate change, the tar sands, disappearing species, the state of the oceans. And the way you can speak out and let the station know you want to keep Radio EcoShock on the air is to renew your membership now or to get a new membership with Co-op Radio. It's not that hard. Pick up the phone, 684-7561, and we'll be glad to take your call. And while we're doing that, we're going to play you a piece of music. This is Jim Page from Seattle, and he's doing a song that I think is pretty important right now as the carrier groups head towards Iranian waters and their saber rattling all over the world, and the situation in Iraq has totally deteriorated into civil war, whether they acknowledge it or not. So this tune is called Something About Us. And on the other side, we'll be heading into a great speech by the new leader of the Green Party, Elizabeth May, on the Alberta tar sands, recorded right here in Vancouver at a speech at the Public Library last June, recorded by Radio EcoShock for you. We've saved it up, and here it comes following this song.
I saw the pictures from the prison in Iraq. The man on the box with his hands on the wires and his head in a sack. The man in the hallway with his neck tied to a leash line. The cigarette grins at the soldiers giving up the high sign. Well, I wish I could believe it when they said it was an aberration. Just a few bad apples in an otherwise smooth operation. But there's just too many cracks in that tired old ruse. And now everybody gets to see Uncle Sam's got blood all over his brand new shoes. His brand new shoes, and there's something about us that we don't want to have to face. There's a killer instinct deep in this American race. And just ask anyone who's been on the other end of that leash, and they'll tell you. Selective memory loss is like a panacea. Big city cops took an immigrant man named Abner Louima, and they brought him downtown and they sodomized him with a toilet plunger. Never would have known, but somebody talked and the story came out from under. Now I know what you're thinking, cops ain't soldiers. But sometimes the line gets blurred, and they've been scratching each other's back for a while now, I've heard. When there's a war around the world, you know that there's a war at home. And they will do whatever they want to you when they get you alone. Get you alone, and there's something about us that we don't want to have to face. And there's a killer instinct deep in this American race. Just ask anyone who's been on the other end of that leash, and they'll tell you. You want to really understand that you gotta go back a ways, back to the founding mythologies of what they call the good old days. The Indian Wars and the Wild West, and guns in everybody's hand. The violence was good then, it gave us a motherland. Now sometimes things got out of control, and they crossed that unspeakable line. Cutting off body parts and wearing them around, I guess soldiers just do that sometimes. We use your imagination. You know that they were feeling good. You know they would have taken pictures if they could. Cause there's something about us that we don't want to have to face. Yeah, there's a killer instinct deep in this American race. Just ask anyone who's been on the other end of that leash, and they'll tell you. Prison right now, and pretty soon we're gonna have more. And I shudder to think about what I've heard goes on behind those doors. It's just the worst kind of sex and violence, and we know that's a fact. But nobody seems to care about it too much until it shows up in Iraq, and I guess that's the problem. We don't seem to be able to make a connection. We think we're some kind of chosen people. We're waiting for a resurrection, but our Savior is a con man, and he's looking out for number one. He'll give you $24 worth of junk jewelry and take it back at the point of a gun. At the point of a gun, and there's something about us that we don't want to have to face. And there's a killer instinct deep in this American race. Just ask anyone who's been on the other end of that leash. And they'll tell you. Cause there's something about us that we don't want to have to face. And there's a killer instinct deep in this American race. Just ask anyone who's been on the other end of that leash. And they'll tell you. Cause there's something about us.
Something About Us from Seattle songwriter Jim Page, from the CD Head Full of Pictures, available from cdbaby.com or from his website at jimpage.net. How about doing your part to help keeping alternative radio on the air? Let's keep it going at 684-7561. 684-7561. Call us now. We'll renew your membership. It doesn't cost that much. You'll keep it going for another whole year. We really appreciate it. 684-7561. Keep Co-op Radio going at CFRO 102.7 FM. Well, coming up next, as promised, here's a speech by Elizabeth May on the Alberta tar sands, and it couldn't be more timely, as Stephen Harper says we're going to talk about things for another year while consulting with industry, while consulting with industry, while consulting with industry. This is a speech by Elizabeth May given at the UBC Robson Center in Vancouver on June 6, 2006, and sponsored by the BC Sustainable Energy Association. In part one of the speech, Elizabeth May outlines the vision and the failures in Canada's race to control carbon emissions. In part two, Elizabeth May takes on the new giant of carbon emissions in Canada, namely the Athabasca tar sands in Alberta.
One of the really most confusing pieces of data that's thrown about, and it'll take up a lot of the rest of what I want to talk about, is this notion that somehow the U.S. has done better than Canada without having ratified Kyoto. I don't know how many of you have heard this. The U.S. has done better than we have because their emissions have risen since 1990 by 16%, and our emissions have risen by almost 25%, and therefore the U.S. did better at reducing emissions. Well, number one, of course, the fact that the U.S. emissions have risen by 16% above 1990 levels does not suggest they're actually doing anything to reduce emissions. In fact, their emissions, as I mentioned earlier, they're 25% of the world's emissions. Canada is 3% of world's emissions. So while there is no excuse for us not meeting our Kyoto target, neither is it really comparable that when the U.S. emissions go up by 16%, that's over a billion tons of greenhouse gases because it's such a large component. They're still the world's biggest polluter. No matter how much we look at the fact that China and India are creeping up on them, the U.S. is still the world's biggest polluter, and their emissions have gone up 16% since 1990. Now, Canadian emissions have risen as well, and largely because the government of Canada, particularly under Jean Chrétien, 1993, he hadn't been at Rio, but he showed up with a Red Book commitment that was so much better than anything Mulroney promised that I really believed they'd be better. And the Red Book commitment in 1993 committed Canada, if the Liberals were to come to power, with a 20% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Now, this is, I'm sorry for this, but it's a different base year. They promised a 20% emissions reductions against 1988 levels to be achieved by 2005. And as you know, by 2005, we'd gone up by about 25%. So clearly not a target that they reached. It's hard to hit a target when you don't aim at it. And that was Mr. Chrétien's biggest problem, was that he went on to then, within a few months of becoming prime minister, go to Alberta and promise that the tar sands would receive federal help for development. And that's been the biggest problem. The difference between the 16% rise in the U.S., and the 25% rise in Canada, just looking at it by percentages and not by tons, is the Athabasca tar sands. They were not up and running and functioning the way they do now in 1990, and that's why I say it's the big carbon elephant in the room. Way back in the early days of the tar sands in the 1970s, there wasn't much going on. Syncrude had federal government ownership, Alberta government ownership. It was the biggest player in the oil sands, tar sands, and it wasn't doing very much. Now, granted, and a lot of you know about the concern with the end of oil, that the cheap and available oil is running out on this planet, no question. So that means that something that was completely uncommercial and never considered part of global oil reserves became attractive. So when we talk about the tar sands, the first thing I need you to get into your mind, if you can visualize it, I don't know, the name is not very descriptive of the ecosystem. This is not a vast Canadian northern equivalent of the Sahara. This is boreal forest. These are rich, functioning ecosystems, large carbon sinks of boreal forest, muskeg, wetland, migratory bird habitat, caribou habitat. This is pristine forest, or at least it used to be. That's what is just under, if you're prepared to strip away all the boreal forest and dig, you find this kind of oily substance. It is, the tar sands are by percentage about 85% clay, sand, and rock, and about 10% this viscous oily substance called bitumen. It can be described as tarry, it can be described as like molasses. One thing it isn't is cheap and easy to get. So you have to be pretty desperate for oil to decide that this is a good place to go look for it. But now they're realizing that it's technically feasible to get at an estimated 280 to 300 billion barrels of crude that's locked up, so inconvenient for the industry, locked up under boreal forests and tons of rock and sand and sediment and muskeg and so on. This volume of crude, now that it's entered global reserves, as though it is because it's technically feasible to go get it, is more than the reserves of Saudi Arabia. And by the way, Canada is already exporting more oil and gas to the U.S. than Saudi Arabia. So we go from the broken Red Book commitment to the Athabasca tar sands in the early 90s. Now, I should mention that back in the 1970s, when Peter Lougheed was premier of Alberta, he was premier from 71 to 85. And one of the things that he felt was that someday there would be a big boom in the tar sands, and not because he cared about ecology. I don't think that was a driver at all, but he did feel there should be a sort of orderly development. So they created someone who was in charge. They called them the Northeast Commissioner for Oil Development, and Peter Lougheed has been quoted as saying, "We called him the Tsar." And the idea was that things would become orderly in the way they went forward. Now, in addition to the Earth Summit happening 14 years ago in 1992, another global ecological event happened, but it wasn't a good one. It was the election of Ralph Klein as Premier of Alberta. One of the first things that Ralph Klein did, because he liked market forces even more than Peter Lougheed, he decided to get rid of the Tsar thing. They didn't think they needed that. And by 1996, Klein looked at the fact that the tar sands weren't developing fast enough, and oil prices were still less than $20 U.S. a barrel. So Ralph Klein lowered the royalties for tar sands development to 1% until companies recovered all their capital costs. That after cost recovery, it would rise to 25%. This constituted a huge giveaway. According to the Globe and Mail report on business, 1% is one of the lowest oil royalty rates on the planet. So before 1996, Suncor had been paying 30% less its costs on the oil, and suddenly it's paying 1%. And then when it starts making money, it's allowed to be charged 25%. By comparison, Venezuela's royalty rates for conventional oil, about 30%. Norway, with not having to get it out of bitumen crude, Norway charges about $14 a barrel, whereas in Alberta it's coming out now to about $4 a barrel. So this is a nice corporate giveaway item. And right now we're watching this mount, but what else is going on? We know the provincial government has made it easy for the oil and gas industry with very low royalty rates. In 1993, I mentioned that Chrétien promised the tar sands money. It was a very, very pivotal trip that Chrétien took to Edmonton. I don't know how many of you follow politics closely enough to remember that one of the only Liberals elected in Alberta was Anne McClellan in Edmonton. She was dubbed Landslide Annie because she won by 17 votes. Chrétien flew out to Edmonton and did two key things. One was he announced $3 billion as a giveaway to get the tar sands development going. And the other was, now that we'd signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change and ratified it, there was an ongoing, as always in Canada, multi-stakeholder process involving federal government, provincial governments, and interested stakeholders, including the environmental movement, to examine what measures would work to reduce emissions. And there were 80 measures that were being analyzed through the federal system with provincial governments and others. One of those measures was a carbon tax. So when Chrétien went to the tar sands, he also announced Canada would not even consider a carbon tax, and it was removed from being a subject for study. We never could even analyze what its economic and ecological impacts would be. But that wasn't enough. So in 1996, the federal government did more to subsidize the tar sands boom. In 1996, the federal government created an accelerated capital cost allowance for companies operating in the tar sands that they could deduct up to 100% of the cost of their equipment against their first year's income. That comes to about $1 billion a year in direct subsidies. Chrétien further shielded the tar sands, by the way, from Kyoto implementation. Just on the eve of ratification in Kyoto in 2002, Chrétien promised any tar sands companies that if in the course of limiting their emissions, it should ever cost more than $15 a ton to reduce emissions, the difference would be made up by the Canadian taxpayer, And he also promised that emission reductions targets for the industry would be different from emission reductions targets in the rest of the plan and would adopt the George Bush approach, which is called an intensity target, which means instead of saying you should reduce your emissions by half, that you should reduce your emissions by half, I just picked out of thin air, by any amount, you should reduce your emissions by half as an actual figure is worth having. You should reduce your emissions by half by as a measure of every unit of production depends on how your unit of productions are going up. So an intensity target is all about reductions per barrel of oil. So what's happening to the barrels of oil? Well, in about 1995, they were up to about a half a million barrels of oil a day produced in the tar sands. They went from a half a million barrels of oil a day in 1995. By 2000, were up to a million barrels a day. And by 2011, it's anticipated it will go to 2 million barrels of oil a day. And then it's projected to rise from there. We are now responsible for 16% of all the oil that the United States imports, and most of it is from the tar sands. So that, again, is just this extraordinary exponential growth in what we're selling. But here's the irony. Why are we subsidizing the wealthiest corporations in the world to sell dirty crude to the United States cheaply to burn in SUVs in a country that isn't committed to any Kyoto targets at all? Now, that's the economics of it. What are the ecological impacts of the tar sands development? And they are many. Actually, before I get to the ecological impacts, I want to tell you something about what's happened to Fort McMurray. Many people will assume that the streets of Fort McMurray must be paved with gold by now. Reality is Fort McMurray is not a happy place because the tar sands boom is causing unbearable social pressures. The population of Fort McMurray has gone from, oh, in 1971, just under 7,000 people. By 1981, over 30,000. And today, 70,000 people live in Fort McMurray. 20% of them have no fixed address. The housing crisis is acute. They are expecting 8% year growth to continue. It's been 8% a year since 1998 and no sign of stopping. There's an acute lack of workers for the tar sands. It's so significant that it's anticipated that by 2007, that all of the province of Alberta, so this isn't Fort McMurray alone, but the entire province of Alberta, will rely on 20,000 temporary foreign workers. The Canadian Resources Horizon Mine, and this is an environmental assessment where I appeared on behalf of Sierra Club of Canada as the only intervener against getting a permit because of the climate impacts. The Canadian Resources Horizon Mine this year brought in 200 temporary workers from China. And meanwhile, there's an Edmonton construction company that's figured out how to solve the acute lack of workers by hiring prisoners who are entitled to day passes. It has some of the highest crime rates anywhere in Canada. It has very, very significant drug problems because you've got workers. In order to hang on to workers, they are paid a small fortune. I mean, the wages in Fort McMurray are so distorting that at this point, in order to be to qualify for low-income housing in Fort McMurray, the poverty line is for anyone earning less than $65,000 a year. It has an acute health care crisis. There are two doctors for every 6,500 people. I've spoken to the doctors in Fort McMurray, and they talk about how they've seen every kind of high-risk behavior you can imagine inside the work camps with these guys who are being paid a fortune and have no place to spend their money. So prostitution, drugs, violent crime, HIV, AIDS, everything is going on in these work camps.
You're listening to a speech given in June in Vancouver by the new leader of the Green Party, Elizabeth May. This is CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and we really need your help. Give us a call at 684-7561 to renew your membership or to become a member. And incidentally, there's lots of benefits to being a member. You get discounts at various stores around the town. 684-7561. It's easy. Let's get back to Elizabeth May talking crude to crud on the tar sands.
But the disaster to society represented by the tar sands extends beyond Fort McMurray, of course. The toxic contaminants released from tar sands operations are the most likely culprit in a recent cancer spike in the Cree population of Fort Chipewyan. Air quality is profoundly bad. I've talked to many people in Fort McMurray who tell you they know when Syncrude is venting the pipes because that's when their kids get asthma attacks. And water quality is significantly at risk. The amount of water that the tar sands operations consume is mind-boggling. Because going from this bitumen crud into usable crude takes profligate amounts of two things that we really can't afford to waste: energy and water. The province of Alberta, unlike the province of Ontario, charges virtually nothing for access to water. The Department of Environment for Alberta does not factor into the water licenses they are granting for pulling water out of the Athabasca River for the impact of climate change and the fact the Athabasca River flow is already declining. So they've already committed, companies in the Athabasca tar sands region already have legal rights to take water from the Athabasca River equivalent to all the water use by the city of Calgary in a year times two. It's vast quantities of water. For every barrel of oil produced, it's somewhere between 4 to 6 barrels of water that are consumed. Now, of course, the water doesn't come out very pretty at the other end, so there are large tailings ponds to hold the contaminated water while it settles. The tailings ponds, I mean, everything about the Fort McMurray tar sands operations is spelled out in gargantuan letters. This is just the first of the stats I'm going to give you, give a sense of scale. The tar sands tailings ponds, think of tailings ponds. Ponds automatically sound sort of small. They should call them the tailings oceans. People would then get the picture. The tailings ponds at the tar sands already occupy an area equivalent to 50 square kilometers. And the dams that hold in that tar sands tailing pond area are some of the largest man-made structures on Earth. This is all stuff that's visible from outer space now. Now, to get the bitumen crude out of the ground, first of all, as I mentioned, you have to remove all the forest. So you destroy the entire surface layer of life. You remove the forest, you destroy the muskeg, and you start digging. Now, they're prepared to dig for any bitumen crude as much as 75 meters below the Earth's surface. They'll dig down as much as 75 meters. Below that, they don't give up and go away. No, no, no. They have what they call in situ mining, which involves pumping either steam water or cool water or saline water to attempt to move the bitumen crude up towards the surface. So they have a very sophisticated, very water-intensive in situ mining as well as the strip mining. 75 meter down, they're prepared to dig away at the earth in one of the world's largest strip mining operations. The trucks that do this work, you talk to men who work in that work, you know, you're basically walking up two flights to get to the front door of your truck. And then you get to work and you dig up the bitumen and you put it into large trucks and you ship it in from this open pit mine. And each mine takes up thousands of hectares. These are not small mines. So they dig it all up and they take it to be refined into crude, and you're using a lot of water, but you also have to use a lot of energy. So the energy equivalent for a barrel of oil produced from the Athabasca tar sands is the equivalent to 1/3 to 1/2 a barrel. Okay, now you can see, where are they going to get all the energy to keep running these operations in northern Alberta? That's what the Mackenzie Gas Pipeline is for. They're going to build gas platforms at the mouth of the Mackenzie River at the Beaufort Sea. 2 out of 3, by the way, are in bird sanctuaries. Then they're going to run a 1,300-kilometer-long pipeline under the surface. So it's a subsurface pipeline through inconsistent permafrost, which, due to the impacts of the climate crisis, much of this permafrost is already melting, particularly far north near the mouth of the river. This is an engineering nightmare. But the end point of all of this movement of natural gas is another pipeline that brings it into the Athabasca tar sands. Now, natural gas is also in short supply globally. Natural gas is not a perfect fuel. Certainly getting it out of the Beaufort Sea, digging it up, and putting it through that pipeline is a significant ecological disaster. The Mackenzie Pipe, the Mackenzie Valley is one-sixth, the whole watershed is one-sixth the landmass of Canada, and is one of our last untouched wildernesses. This will industrialize that entire area. There's a lot wrong with the Mackenzie Gas Pipeline. But one might be able to say, well, I guess we really need that natural gas because, after all, we won't want to go to coal. We could use that natural gas to run electricity generation. But the reality is most of the Mackenzie gas, if not all, is going to go to the Athabasca tar sands to turn that bitumen crud into crude to be sold to the U.S. It's been described, the process of taking clean, relatively clean-burning natural gas and turning it into Athabasca tar sands crude has been described as a process of turning gold into lead. It's quite extraordinary. Now, even if we used all the gas from the Beaufort Sea for the Athabasca tar sands, it's still probably not enough energy. So recently, Ralph Klein decided nuclear reactors wouldn't be too bad in the Athabasca tar sands region. And the government of Saskatchewan under Lauren Calvert is seriously considering a nuclear reactor at northwestern Saskatchewan to sell electricity to the Athabasca tar sands operations. And there's a French investor who wants to get into the Athabasca tar sands, promises they'll build their own reactor if they're allowed to get in. It's quite extraordinary. So when you take all this together, we've got massive destruction of boreal forest, migratory bird habitat, caribou habitat, wetlands, muskeg, and, of course, the carbon sequestration that all of that area represented in holding carbon out of the atmosphere. You've got this huge impact on the quantity of available water in the region, in a region where, as Dr. David Schindler, one of Canada's leading scientists, who's a scientist at the University of Alberta, Edmonton, is warning, Alberta is heading for a water crisis. The glaciers are all in retreat. The snowpack isn't the same. Farmers, ranchers, groundwater are going to be in short supply. And meanwhile, the greediest water consumer in the province is the Athabasca tar sands, and they show no sign of understanding that they can't have what they want. And we have the greenhouse gas impact. Told you in general terms how large it is. Here's to get a picture of where it's going. I mentioned that by 2011, they expect to have doubled it to 2 million barrels a day of oil produced. By that time, it's anticipated that the greenhouse gas emissions from those operations alone, not including when you burn that oil running in somebody's car in the States, but the greenhouse gas emissions from the upstream costs of producing the oil will be the equivalent to, and this is a low-end figure, by the way, 70 million tons of CO2 every year. Now, 70 megatons, or 70 million tons, is a huge chunk of the gap that Canada has to meet to get to our Kyoto target. In fact, our total Kyoto gap is 280 megatons. So 70 megatons is a rather large contribution to our overall gap. And that's the reason that U.S. emissions, as a percentage, I mean, in, as I said, in tonnage, there's no question, U.S. emissions far outstripped Canadian. But as a percentage matter, the difference between U.S. emissions increases and Canadian emissions increases is us feeding the U.S. addiction for fossil fuels by selling them the dirtiest carbon crude on the face of the earth, subsidized by the Canadian taxpayer, and subsidized by the people of Alberta who are giving away the oil at bargain basement royalties. So what can we do about this? Well, I think the first thing that's really critical is to inform ourselves. This is not just a matter of Alberta on its own making decisions about its energy. No doubt some of you have heard Ralph Klein sounding very suspicious that all Canada is looking at the wealth of Alberta and planning to pounce on it and steal it, so that we can live our slovenly, lazy ways, unlike Albertans. I mean, it's so outrageous. The thing that is extraordinary about this is Ralph Klein's rhetoric never takes into account the fact that he wouldn't have the Athabasca tar sands producing 1 million barrels of oil a day if the federal government hadn't been so extraordinarily generous to the tar sands industry. And when the federal government gives very advantageous accelerated capital cost allowances and grants and all of that, that's taxpayers. We hear a lot about, from, you know, parts of society about we don't like subsidies for mass transit or we don't want subsidies for daycare. But no, I don't hear a lot of people in Mr. Harper's cabinet complaining about the corporate welfare bums running the Athabasca tar sands. The wealthiest corporations in the world are getting some of the most preferential tax treatment for a product that is the world's most profitable product, to which people are addicted. You really don't need to subsidize the production of oil and gas. As a U.S. Congressman Markey, commenting on this in U.S. hearings on the subsidies that the Bush administration gives oil and gas, he said, you know, subsidizing the oil and gas industry is like subsidizing a fish to swim. You don't need to do it. Oil is $70 a barrel, and they are making a killing, a literal killing. So first phase is understand what this is about and begin to at least say, we're not trying to steal anything from Alberta, but we think that the oil and gas companies should, at a very, very minimum, pay the full cost of what they're doing. They should pay for the water they're taking out of the Athabasca River, which currently they take for free. They should pay the full costs to the tax system of what they're doing. Why should oil and gas companies get an accelerated capital cost allowance that people developing a cogeneration plant can't get? And we should have a moratorium. A lot of permits have already been given that take us to 2 million barrels of oil a day, but they're lining up. As a matter of fact, they're falling over each other to get in the tar sands. It's so significant that Peter Lougheed, again, I'll quote him, without his czar, he bemoans the fact that it's actually hurting the economy of Alberta, that there's such a complete chaos of development going on. Lougheed calls it the traffic jam. They all want to get at everything there is as fast as they can. And nobody's in control, nobody's really regulating, and God knows the Ministry of Department of Environment for Alberta allows emissions levels from these facilities that are dangerous to local people. So a moratorium on any new projects, reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the tar sands immediately. A lot of discussion going on about whether tar sands development could be carbon neutral. The first step is to make sure there's no new development for long enough to take stock of greenhouse gas emissions, impact on wetlands, impact on water, and local pollution, and make the industry pay the cost of its operations. Then it's critical that having slowed down our worst problem in Canada, we look at how we meet our Kyoto targets in the first commitment period till 2012 and how we meet the real target beyond 2012, which by 2020, to avoid tipping points in the global atmosphere that will affect global climate in ways that are irreversible, we need to reduce emissions by 30% below 1990 levels by 2020. We really don't have time for any more mistakes. We don't have time for any more nonsense from governments. And by 2030, by 2050, the ultimate target by 2050 is now about 80%. Below 1990 levels by 2050. And if you can't imagine a government brave enough to announce that they're committed to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050, then imagine a Republican governor for the United States, the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, that's his target. 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. And California has the toughest vehicle regulations anywhere in North America. And, of course, the big three auto companies are in there in court trying to stop them. The California assemblywoman who got the law passed through the California legislature to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the automobile fleet by 25%, her name is Fran Pavley. She said, I just wish these car companies would put away their lawyers and get out their engineers. But they show up and they fight everything. But there are progressive jurisdictions, and Canada could be one of them. But we first have to face the big problem that we can't have our cake and eat it too, We can't claim to be, as the Liberals did in the past, a Kyoto-compliant nation while hoping nobody notices that we're subsidizing the tar sands and selling it to the United States. We also can't be a responsible nation by pretending that we're going to do something called a Made in Canada plan that might happen someday, when we're really all about destroying global progress by being an anti-Kyoto country hiding inside the Kyoto Protocol. So these things require a lot of public engagement, a lot of participation, and I would urge all of you to help. Now, there are a couple things you can do. There's certainly supporting the British Columbia Sustainable Energy Association, and there's also a terrific program that I wanted to bring to your attention that's been launched by the City of Vancouver called the One Day Program. Vivian, you want to stand up for just a sec? I want you to see Vivian with the City of Vancouver program One Day, and she's got a nice little clipboard, really easy. You can sign up, and these are great efforts that you can take to be a positive player in reducing greenhouse gases here in Vancouver. The cities, by the way, God bless the cities of Canada. They had the Federation of Canadian Municipalities meeting recently in Montreal, and they issued a consensus declaration to Mr. Harper to say, you can't walk away from Kyoto, we won't let you, we'll still meet our targets. By the way, in the United States, started by Mayor Greg Nickels of Seattle, just when the Kyoto Protocol came into legal effect, February 16, 2005, Mayor Greg Nickels thought, Seattle should commit to the Kyoto targets. Who cares if George Bush doesn't? Seattle will commit, and I'll challenge other mayors to do the same. And he had collected over 100 cities by July when he announced his program. And I never forget one of the cities that I thought was so impressive. There was a mayor who signed that statement. Of course, I didn't read it in the Canadian press. I hate to tell you, I read it in The Guardian. But a U.S. mayor who said, why is it George Bush is president? We all admire the fact that he didn't wait to find out if Saddam Hussein was really dangerous. He could see the threat and he took action. How come he doesn't see the threat of climate change and respond in the same way? And this mayor who made this clever analogy went on to say, my city's probably the most vulnerable city anywhere in the United States of America, the most vulnerable city to the threat of global warming. And that mayor was Ray Nagin, mayor of New Orleans. He saw the light a little too late, and it's a terrible tragedy. But just before the climate change conference started in November in Montreal, the 200th U.S. mayor had signed on. So 200 U.S. mayors committed to Kyoto, the Federation of Canadian Municipalities committed to Kyoto, all the New England governors, in combination with the Eastern Canadian premiers, have a regional Kyoto target. We've got California, we've got U.S. congressmen and senators. Increasingly, George Bush has no one he can count on anymore except for Stephen Harper. So we really need to face the climate crisis at the level of the science, the personal actions we all can take, and the politics of where does Canada stand in the world. And it also means that without being unfriendly, because, frankly, the people of Alberta are more at risk from the impacts of climate change than almost any other Canadians, because the water crisis that's heading for them will be far worse than anything that happened in the Dust Bowl. And there are a lot of Albertans who don't get their bread and butter from oil and gas. They're ranchers and they're farmers and they're in tourism and they're in deep, deep trouble. And their government doesn't give a damn because there's not a Made in Canada plan coming down the pipe. It's a Made in Houston plan. And if it leaves the people of Alberta behind in poverty once the boom is gone, they don't care. So this is not a hostile towards Alberta speech I'm giving you. This is a we can't let the fossil fuels of northern Alberta be consumed at this rate with this level of ecological damage by a bunch of bandits masquerading as a premier and a prime minister. So I'm asking for your help to spread the word that Kyoto is not dead, that other countries are moving forward, and that for Canada to do its part, we have to stop the expansion of the Athabasca tar sands and look at the environmental damage and the social threats and all the issues in Fort McMurray and act in a positive way to create a sustainable future for that region, that province, and all of Canada. Thank you very much.
That concludes part two of a speech given by Elizabeth May on June 6, 2006 in Vancouver. It was sponsored by the BC Sustainable Energy Association and recorded by Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. That's it for Radio EcoShock. Tune in next Friday and every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver.